I've called my paper Edward Gordon Craig, The Forgotten Modernist, because I want to use a biographical narrative to sketch in the background of his career, in particular his early life and experience in the theatre in Britain, particularly in London. I hope to show what led to his exile from this country and how exile, alienation, and his extreme reaction to conventional theatre productions in Britain impelled him towards an alternative modernist programme in Europe. At the same time, his solitary, embattled nature and perfectionist agenda helped to conceal his visionary achievements, which, being less evident in his later life, became virtually forgotten by the time he died, leaving a legacy for us, for you, to explore, which is what we're doing today. There are perhaps three or four people in Edward Gordon Craig's early life, say three and a half, who I believe had a decisive influence on his career as an imaginative theatre designer. And the first of these, perhaps rather surprisingly, was his godfather, the great 19th century tragedian Henry Irving, about whom in later life Craig wrote an extraordinary eulogistic book. Irving was the first knight of the British stage, the Knight from Nowhere, he was called. He was also, it was said, the original of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Stoker was Irving's business manager at the Lyceum Theatre. I should say something of Irving so as to account for his influence on Craig. Irving was an only child, born into an impoverished West Country working-class family, without, it seemed, any hope of advancement. To be an actor, he had to overcome many difficulties. His severe short-sightedness. He had to gain control over an uncoordinated and awkward body. Above all, he had to quell his dreadful stammer. He practiced in solitude, and when he put on his makeup and spoke the words of Shakespeare's characters, the stammer miraculously lifted and left him. He turned his physical defects into dramatic strengths and was able to fill theatre audiences with a sense of horror, suspense, excitement, fear. That was the peculiar nature of his talent. But to achieve all this, he had to leave his parents while in his teens and change his family name, which had been Brodribb, and this was to avoid humiliating his mother, who believed the fate of an actor was to spend eternity in hell. She never forgave him, never saw him again, and died too soon to learn of his success. That at least was spared her. All this, perhaps, is significant in relation to Craig. I mean, the change of name, the escape from parental authority, particularly a mother's authority. Irving's success didn't come quickly. His partner at the Lyceum was, of course, Craig's mother, Ellen Terry, another vital influence on him. She was an enchantress, and she had a genius for making people feel happy. The Times was to call her the uncrowned queen of England. And Virginia Woolf, in one of her last essays, speculated on how dramatically the course of British history might have changed had Ellen Terry actually been on the throne instead of Queen Victoria. The Lyceum Theatre was Craig's home from home, a magic place of fantasy and happiness. He loved Henry Irving's theatre, Peter Brook was to write, its painted forests, its thunder sheets, its naive melodrama. And he felt immensely excited to be given small parts to play as a child and adolescent. Sedekind's brilliant mythological landscapes, the Lyceum productions became a pictorial record of late Victorian life. Irving and Terry created a cathedral of the arts there, of painting and music, as well as of acting. The theatre was a place of popular entertainment and a landmark in the romantic revival which was spreading through Britain. Irving edited Shakespeare so as to suit his own acting skills and the taste of his audiences. Craig was very responsive to that editing of Shakespeare. What Hollywood became to the 20th century, the Lyceum became in Britain during the late 19th century. Irving and Terry really symbolised the spirit of the times in which Craig grew up. Ellen Terry's private life was very different from what the public saw her on stage imagined. It was, of course, to be recognised well enough by her children. She had been the child bride of England's Michelangelo, as he was called, the middle-aged allegorical painter G.F. Watts, who in the magic laboratory of his studio transformed her into one spectacular figure after another. Joan of Arc, Shakespeare's Othello, Dante's Francesca, and a beautiful maiden protected from the dangers of the medieval world by her courtly knight. But, alas, Watts was no courtly knight. And the marriage lasted less than 1 year, ending in much sexual confusion and unhappiness. It was a natural, almost inevitable catastrophe, Ellen admitted. I wish I were dead, she wrote to a friend. I'd like to try how drowning feels. On the night of the 10th of August, 1868, she disappeared, and her parents reported her disappearance to the police. A few days later, the body of a young girl was found floating in the Thames, and Ellen's father was called to the morgue, where he identified his daughter. News of her death soon reached Ellen, and she hurried back to reassure the family that she was still alive, but what she told them may have seemed to be a fate worse than death. She had run away to live with William Godwin, an architect friend of Whistler and of Oscar Wilde. He was a notorious, talented, and very handsome character, known sometimes as the Wicked Earl. He wasn't an earl. But Ellen loved him passionately, and they were to have two illegitimate children, a daughter called Edith and their son, Edward. Edie and her brother Edward were very close in childhood and during their adolescent years. She gave him a sense of self-esteem, and he later remembered, "She fought my battles." His real enemy was within, an anxious, greedy self. "Be a woman," Edie would urge him when he was overcome by anxiety. And so he would climb the tree she was climbing, seeming to add to his stature by giving himself a wider horizon. Height was always important to him in his theatre designs. Edie was a couple of years older than Edward and took the lead when, at parties, they danced together. Edie was strong-minded. "I was decidedly not," he wrote in his memoirs. "I was never happier than with Edie." There's a charming passage Craig contributed to a book of reminiscences about Edie that describes her piano playing with their mother, Ellen Terry. "Duets they played," he wrote, "and Edie, despairing to improve my mother, took to arguing, and the fierce torrent of music ceased, and logic took its place. Edie explained that if a piece was written to be played slowly and with such and such an emphasis, it was not being polite to the composer, especially if his name was Brahms." Here mother peered at the music to see the name of this celebrated being. "Yes, it is Brahms," she murmured. "Let's try again," Edie would say. And again mother dashed in and on, and Edie came following after. Again a traffic jam. "What's the matter?" "Twice too fast," said Edie. And the funny thing was that she was right, and mother couldn't believe her own daughter. She didn't believe her own son either, he was implying. He added that while Edie was right, Mother was not wrong. Edie was literally correct, though the impulsive Ellen had caught the spirit of the piece. And where was Edward in all this? Why wasn't he playing the piano? He believed himself to be more naturally gifted than his sister. She was less musically haunted than I, he wrote. And he was certainly more knowledgeable than his mother. Why had he been left out? This sense of being underrated and an outsider was to gain on him over the years. In time, he became more enthralled to architecture and pictures than to people, to the imposing work, for example, of the Venetian architect and engraver Piranesi, and to the dramatic images, tall, dark interiors, of the Scottish painter and designer James Pride. Writing of his childhood when in his 80s, Gordon Craig vividly remembered the time when their mother, having taken a cottage nearby, he and Edie played at Hampton Court. They had made a special friend of the man who was in charge of the famous maze in the gardens there. He would allow them to climb the wooden steps up to the crow's nest platform, where they could look down on the antics of the lost people as they wandered this way and that, laughing at first, and then falling silent at their predicament. It was like a mysterious tragicomedy, like the bewildering maze of their own childhood, with no father to guide them, and an elusive mother who was always disappearing abroad, while their time was taken up with erratic, unsatisfactory schooling at one place and another. Over all this, for a few moments, as they looked down on the maze, they appeared to have ascendancy, to have control. Then they would go inside Hampton Court and walk through the wonderful rooms with their lofty beds, beds which had a lasting effect on Craig's imagination. The impossible, grand, motionless beds, he called them. They seemed to sleep themselves. He would stand there a long time, looking at them in wonder. As a child, he felt dwarfed by them, as his characters on stage were to be dwarfed sometimes by his tiring theatre designs. And the emptiness of the beds. That was how people affected him, by the potency of their absence. William Godwin, his father, was of course wholly absent. He had left Ellen Terry while their son was aged 3, married a student who later became Whistler's wife, and he died in 1886 when Gordon Craig was 14. Craig could not remember ever seeing his father and tended to blame his mother for their separation. If she had stayed with Godwin, he came to believe, his father's genius as an aesthete, architect and designer could have been made manifest. As it was, he remained a tragic figure whose enormous potential went unrealized. It was Gordon Craig's destiny to accomplish what Godwin had been prevented from accomplishing. "I'll inherit that," he wrote in his book, Ellen Terry and Her Secret Self. That book about his mother was published in 1931, 3 years after Ellen Terry's death. And it was dedicated to William Godwin. "I had not wished to write this book." That is his first sentence. He'd been compelled to do so in order to reclaim his mother from his enemy, her loving friend, Bernard Shaw, whose correspondence with Ellen Terry had been published earlier that year, and with Edie's support. Shaw had wanted Ellen Terry for his own play world and had written for her an adventure for the stage called Captain Brassband's Conversion. The character of Lady Cicely Wainfleet is Shaw's ideal of womanhood, someone of farsightedness, tact, and apparent gentleness, who outwits all the men she meets on her travels, and whose power lies in the authority of a mother figure who treats these men like children in a nursery. She's more than a match for Captain Brassband, whose strength arises from his philosophy of revenge. Captain Brassband himself is based on Henry Irving. What Gordon Craig does in his book is to create another Ellen Terry, a secret one. She is his own mother, and not a mother figure for Shaw, or a figure worshipped by her audiences. Simply his mother. In a most radiant passage, he sets the two of them, mother and son, together on the stage. But there's no audience, no public performance. It is the half-dressed stage, a surreal and private place, and they occupy it silently together. It is filled with a marvellous assortment of what look like toys. A painted rock, flat, and casting a long thin shadow on the floor. A couple of cathedral doors leaning against one of the stage walls. Half a street is standing upright towards the centre of the stage, held in place by little cables. On all sides, strange shapes and strangely coloured patterns. Each piece ridiculous, he writes, and yet appearing to us quite natural. It is like a dream, a vision. In the context of this book, this surreal picture shows the preparation for a spectacular Lyceum production. But in Gordon Craig's own career, it may be seen as a dismantling of all that bric-a-brac that cluttered up those old melodramatic war horses of the late Victorian theatre to prepare for the abstract patterns of his own designs. Like Diaghilev, Craig was destroying what he had once loved and creating something very different in its place, something new to love. A year before the publication of Ellen Terry and Her Secret Self, Craig published his book about Henry Irving, a book dedicated to Irving himself, with love and remembrance. Irving had then been dead for a quarter of a century. "No one in his senses can attack Irving," he wrote. But Bernard Shaw had attacked him, and so here he was, Craig's enemy again, who had tried to carry off Ellen Terry from the Lyceum to play in Ibsen's dramas and, of course, in his own. But Ellen stayed with Henry Irving, not because she trusted his judgment, she didn't, but because she loved him. And that it seemed, and that had no, Craig had no objection to her loving him, which is interesting. Irving, as it were, was a replacement for Godwin, his potent missing father. Craig knew, as Shaw did, that Irving made third-rate old-fashioned dramas hugely popular with the public. But that was the fault of the public, Craig argued, not Irving. Shaw has always been an enemy of the theatre, Craig decided. He could not believe that anyone really liked Shaw's plays. All those words? Silence would have been better. No one could make Shaw popular. And certainly he was extremely unpopular with Craig. What Craig admired in Irving was his immense power in the theatre. He was not simply an actor-manager, but a director-dictator, a position Craig himself longed to possess in later years in a different theatre of his own. It was a time of enchantment, these Lyceum years, he remembered. They were positively worth living if you chanced to be a member of Irving's company. But, he added, I had grown ambitious. Irving was so dominant a character, both as an actor and a manager, that there was no chance of advancement at the Lyceum. And so Craig was obliged to turn elsewhere to fulfill his destiny. In his book on Irving, he tries to make a seamless connection between Irving's theatre and his own experimental ideas. I have felt it right to follow Irving's lead, he wrote. But Irving wasn't leading anywhere. He was marking time by the end of the 19th century. Craig knew that. As he puts it, Henry Irving was the full stop to a period in a long chapter of stage history. We have begun a new chapter. Now that is surely true. But Irving did not like what he saw of this new chapter. Craig's efforts to connect Irving's melodramas with his own minimalist theatre and depict Irving as a shadow of a coming event, the Uber Marionette, which was his own powerful trademark, would have astonished Irving himself. It's worth looking briefly at Craig's achievements in this country during the first 3 years of the 20th century. The most significant event at the turn of the century had been his meeting with a musician called Martin Shaw, the Good Shaw. Martin Shaw was a rather gruff, ill-favoured man. He had a disfiguring birthmark on his face. But he was, in Craig's words, a musician to his fingertips. His music came from the landscape and carried potent and poetic images into Craig's imagination. And there was another attribute that commended itself to Craig. Martin Shaw was wholly uncompetitive and always encouraging, what Craig called a good sportsman. The two men worked together in perfect harmony and freedom. Indeed, Martin Shaw was probably the only person who was able to work alongside Craig without some terrible falling out. They first collaborated on a version of Dido and Aeneas for the Purcell Operatic Society at the Hampstead Conservatory of Music in May 1900. The triumph of Craig's sets lay in the use of light, space, and shade, which added immeasurably to the tragic simplicity of the whole performance. Why should we not see more of his work and have other memories of harmony, of colour and form, wrote one critic. Their next presentation was of Purcell's music for the history of Diocletian, I think it was called Mask of Love, which turned out to be, in Craig's opinion, years later, the best thing I ever did, or so I thought it. There was no painted scenery, three walls of light grey canvas and a grey cloth. The figures were black and white, and they moved in and out of different pools of colour. It was the only good scenery I ever saw, W.B. Yeats told him. And the artist Walter Crane wrote to say that his staging strikes quite a new note in the theatre. Crane was an architect that William Godwin greatly admired. Next came an imaginative production of Handel's Acis and Galatea in 1902. It was, in the opinion of Max Beerbohm, an aesthetic success uncontaminated by commercialism. To interpret that, you have to say that, like the previous productions, it lost money. And afterwards, the Purcell Society had to be wound up. Craig, by this time, having given and having spent a good deal of money from his mother. She didn't want to help him into bankruptcy, and that was certainly where he seemed to be heading after a presentation at the end of 1902 of Lauren Hausman's nativity play, Bethlehem. Again, he designed a strong, imaginative, and original production. But it was not the play or the music which he had been given to produce, Hausman later complained. Disemboweled, decapitated, dismembered, he shaped the play's broken fragments into a new identity of its own. With my financial losses about twice what I reckoned they might be, I crept out of the venture with an accompanying loss of temper, Hausman recorded. It was a good example of Craig's ruthless attitude to playwrights, similar in its way to Irving's ruthless editing of Shakespeare, which I mentioned earlier. It was then, in 1903, that Ellen Terry stepped forward to help both her children. She proposed that her son choose a play for her to act in, for which Edie and her friends would make all the costumes, and Gordon Craig was to choose the play, and he chose Ibsen's The Vikings of Helgeland, which had never been performed in England. Poor dear, Irving wrote of Ellen Terry when he heard the news. She is utterly under the influence and spell of her two children who have launched her on a sea of troubles. Yet Gordon Craig's sets were compelling, turning the stage, in the words of Theodore Watts Lunton, into a poem. As the American critic James Huneker observed, he introduced a supernatural element into every scene. The slow movements of the samurai fighting with great flashes of their enormous swords, the sinister glow and mysterious purple shadows which conveyed an atmosphere of dread, and many other bizarre effects altogether different from the uniform monotony of London's West End stagecraft. But the politics of family life disrupted everything. Ellen Terry was unhappy with her part, what she called a wicked woman's part, and surely a grievous spectacle to her adoring public. Gordon Craig was exhibiting to the public, and Ellen Terry, it did not know, the dominating mother who had overwhelmed both his and Edie's early lives. That's what he believed. Ellen was also in name the director of Ibsen's play, but her direction was rudderless. As a result, there was chaos. We will lose unity, Gordon Craig warned, and this is what happened. Each one of them showed up the other's weakness. Edie's professionalism as a costumier, highlighting what seemed to be her brother's amateur experiments, and his visionary imagination making her seem literal and narrow-minded. And there were further difficulties, such as Edie becoming engaged to Martin Shaw, though they never actually got round to marrying. And then Edie's female partner attempting suicide. This is hell. I know nothing more tormenting, complained Gordon Craig, and for once everyone agreed with him. Ellen Terry had wanted to unify her family. Her children needed to find their freedom. Guilt encompassed them all. It was after this that Gordon Craig, much to his mother's distress, exiled himself from England and centred the rest of his career in Europe. He was in trouble with the women in his life, with his mother, with his wife and with his mistress. I forgot to mention his wife and mistress because, really, Craig had also forgotten them. He was also in despair over the British commercial theatre, the unimaginative managers and blind critics. All of them were his enemy. Everyone was his enemy. He wanted to start again, to recreate himself and give birth to a new non-realistic Symbolist theatre. In Europe, he quickly found a new mistress, the American dancer Isadora Duncan, who he believed was trying to do for dance what he was trying to do for drama. And he found a new father figure, Count Harry Kessler, who was mercifully not an actor and had no connection with his family, but was to be Craig's painstaking patron over many years. But over 60 years, Craig produced only three plays in Europe: a spectacular version of Rosmersholm for Eleonora Duse in Florence in 1906, the famous production of Hamlet for Stanislavski in Moscow in 1912, and a controversial production of Ibsen's The Pretenders with Johannes Poulsen in Copenhagen in 1926. To these might be added some striking designs he drew in 1928 for a production of Macbeth in New York, though he did not go to New York. And having plagiarized his own work, signed his sketches CPB, meaning Craig Potboiler. Still, they deserve to be looked at, those designs. What he sought was the absolute authority he had so admired in Henry Irving's Lyceum. But no theatre manager, Reinhardt and others, could cede total control of their entire theatres to him. Craig nursed a paralysing fear of failure. He didn't trust anyone, believing they would steal his ideas. Craig's extraordinary Hamlet, which Harry Kessler published at the Cranach Press at the end of 1929, was less a record of the actual Moscow production than a version of Craig's uncompromising ideas. This book was, in the words of the painter William Rothenstein, certainly Craig's masterpiece as artist and the most important book since William Morris's Chaucer. The impossibility of working with Craig during the last 40 years of his life was well illustrated by a story that hasn't appeared in my book, nor in any other book that I know. You can find it among the papers of the Society of Theatre Research. In the mid-1920s, Craig had come to England and gone to the Festival Theatre in Cambridge at the invitation of Terence Gray, a great admirer of Craig's work, who had converted the disused Georgian playhouse there into an innovative open stage theatre that embodied many of Craig's ideas. After the evening performance, Craig accepted Gray's invitation to lunch the next day at the theatre restaurant. At the end of the lunch, Gray asked him to direct and design a play of his own choice there in the Festival Theatre. "But my dear Gray, I would demand total control," Craig replied. Gray was ready for this. "Naturally, you would have total control of the whole theatre. There is no one in the world to whom I would rather entrust this theatre. But I would need 8 weeks' rehearsal," Craig counted. This was certainly more than Gray had bargained for, but he was in so far there was no turning back. "Agreed," he said. "And I would have to rebuild the theatre," Craig added. Gray had spent a fortune fitting the most advanced lighting, capable of achieving Craig's ideal philosophy of lighting. But he was not going to give up. And he replied, "Certainly, I will arrange for my architect to meet you tomorrow." But Craig was returning to Europe the next day. He promised to write to Gray, and eventually he did write. His letter thanked him for lunch and asked for the name of the vineyard that had produced the excellent wine they had drunk. There's no mention then or later of directing or designing a play. He had lost his nerve. No man in the English language is so hated and reviled, no man so passionately defended and revered, wrote the Irish playwright Lennox Robertson of Gordon Craig. A man who can arouse such feelings of hatred and love can indubitably be no nonentity. Craig's legendary reputation can seem precariously positioned somewhere between the few plays he designed and directed and the many children he fathered. Over 30 years, scattered through 5 countries, he had 13 children by 8 women, and seemed to inflict on them in an extreme form what he complained of having experienced himself as a child, the absent father. Annie Terry loved her children, but she was not naturally gifted as a mother. Indeed, she was very badly cast in the role. When she parted from Godwin, both of them wanted to have Edie, and neither seemed that concerned about Edward. And though he probably never knew this, There is a sense in which he always felt abandoned, not wanted. At Ellen's funeral, as they led the procession from the church at Smallhigh, Edward clutched Edie's arm and whispered in a voice that carried clearly to the mourners, "We must have more occasions like this." It is almost as if, at some level, quite thoughtlessly, he wants to be at Ellen's death many times. He has won a good many tributes to his work. It is impossible to read his books, impossible to look at his designs without being filled with a new sense of the possibilities of the theatre, wrote the art historian James Laver. James Laver, who was keeper of the Department of Engraving, Illustration, Design and Painting here at the V&A. And Peter Brook, who wrote of Craig's revolutionary ideas having become everyday axioms in the designer's language, wrote of him as an inspiration and a warning. After 1930, Craig himself spoke of being left in a parlous state. He'd become a pedagogue in antiquary. At the beginning of his memoirs, published in 1957, 9 years before his death at the age of 94, he summed up his position poignantly. "In my life, I have done the best I could, and yet I have done next to nothing." It has been left to others, after his death, to fulfill his great potential. That is his legacy, and that is why we are here today.